Well, it's my honor to introduce Kennette Benedict. She has been the executive director of the Bulletin Atomic Scientists since 2005. Their goal is to inform the public about the dangers of nuclear weapons, climate change, and emerging technologies in life sciences. She also teaches at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, where she is also a senior fellow at the Energy Policy Institute. Before joining the Bulletin, Benedict was a director of the International Peace and Security at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. So you can contact Kennette at www.thebulletin.org. And so I would like now to introduce Kennette, who will then introduce the panelists.
Thank you, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. I've just come from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Symposium in Washington on Thursday and our board meeting yesterday, where we talk about the setting of the hand of the doomsday clock, which we are the keepers of. I'm unfortunately not able to tell you what we decided. That will come in mid-January. But as we reviewed the events of the last year or so, there are some, I would say, aspects of the nuclear program which give us all pause, and I'll be talking about some of that later. But my great pleasure now is to introduce the panel, Nuclear Power, Nuclear Weapons, The Connections. Nuclear energy, as you all know, comes from splitting uranium atoms, and that first self-sustaining chain reaction took place here at the University of Chicago in a project led by Enrico Fermi 70 years ago. And before that, German scientists had published in 1939 the possibility of the release of this enormous energy source. The news flew across the Atlantic and throughout the international community of physicists, German, Russian, Japanese, Italian, French, the United States was almost the last to hear about this. But in the course of the war, this energy source quickly became the source of the enormous bomb, the first nuclear bomb that was used in World War II. The motivation was to get the bomb before Hitler did, because the Germans clearly knew about this enormous energy source. Many of the scientists, though, including Fermi, had always wanted this first to be used for nuclear power for peaceful uses rather than for the bomb. The speakers on this panel today will review that history from those early days. It all started here, or almost all started here. They will, though, bring us up to date and provide the context in which this very dangerous dual-use technology is deployed and continues to develop. I'd like to ask Paul Gunter to speak first. He has more than 35 years' experience as an anti-nuclear activist and safe energy advocate. He's the director of the Reactor Oversight Project for Beyond Nuclear in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He was co-founder of the New England-based Clamshell Alliance, which in 1976 opposed the construction of the Seabrook nuclear power plant in New Hampshire, something many of us with gray hair remember very well. Bob Alvarez is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and a senior advisor at Friends of the Earth. He has served as a senior policy advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Energy, where, among other things, he led teams into North Korea to secure spent nuclear reactor fuel at the Yongbyon nuclear site. From 1988 to 1993, Bob served on the majority staff of the U.S. Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs, where, among other things, he helped establish independent safety oversight of the DOE nuclear weapons complex. And then we'll turn to Kendra Ulrich, who is a nuclear campaigner for Friends of the Earth. She served as the New Hampshire Coordinator for Safe and Green Campaign and on the Coordinating Committee for the Regional SAGE Alliance, working to shut down the Vermont Yankee nuclear reactor, which hasn't quite happened, but boy, came close. While in graduate school, she also served as the Freeze Our Fukushima's Outreach Coordinator for Beyond Nuclear. We've asked each of the panelists to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, and we hope then that will give us about an hour for discussion and questions from all of you. I want to also remind the panelists that we'd like you to tell us what you think we should do. So those are the instructions going forward. Paul, let's start with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Again, my name is Paul Gunter. I'm director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear. And I was asked to give some opening remarks for this panel with regard to the historic perspective of the connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And I, frankly, I think the most apropos quote to open this presentation is from George Bernard Shaw, who said, "We learn from history that we learn nothing from history." And now we are 7 decades into the nuclear conundrum, and our plight deepens. The horizons are for an aging industry of weapons and power. There are now 436 nuclear power reactors with operating licenses in 36 nations around the world. Collectively, they have generated more than 250,000 metric tons of nuclear waste, principally irradiated nuclear fuel alone, and literally mountains more of radioactive uranium mine tailings and the detritus from reactor operations, the nuclear fuel chain, and ultimately decommissioning. This same mountain of irradiated used nuclear fuel contains the materials for nuclear weapons, particularly plutonium. And if you go to the Plowshares Fund's website, while it's difficult to actually come up with a real number of nuclear weapons in the world today, we know of 19,000 such weapons of mass destruction globally among 5 professed superpowers and 4 the known to possess nuclear weapon nations. This is coupled with the ever-increasing concern for the unknown loose nukes that are out there from this production cycle. And as nations collapse, political instability generates the operation for these weapons of mass destruction to fall into corrupt hands that would, you know, basically present the ultimate weapon of coercion. The inextricable connection between weapons and power is a well-documented history of the atomic age. It is a history of 7 decades, largely without accountability, without liability. In most recent history, the nuclear catastrophe in Japan is now officially acknowledged by the Japan National Diet's official report, the Fukushima Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Committee, in strong words, as a man-made disaster, the result of a multitude of errors and willful negligence created by a history of bureaucratic collusion of government, regulator, and industry to hide their mistakes and mask over their vulnerabilities. Willful negligence by people, decision makers, presidents, managers in positions of government, regulation, and industry. Where is the accountability and the liability while we make history today? Now, more than 1.5 years after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe, there are more than 250,000 children who live in radioactive contaminated land around the ruin and rubble of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident. The chairman of the Diet Independent Investigation, Kiyoshi Kurokawa, writes in the report's preamble, "What is to be admitted very painfully is that this was a disaster made in Japan." Yes, but at the same time, Fukushima Daiichi catastrophe was manufactured in the global context of the history of the atomic age. Converging chronologies, a failure to learn from history, to forget and unlearn lessons from the atomic bomb survivors of St. George, Utah, the children of Chernobyl in Ukraine and Belarus and beyond, the indigenous peoples of the world living for decades in the poisoned ruins and detritus of uranium mining for the atomic age, and the mind-numbing, pointless purpose, lack of accountability, and liability that may yet come in the aftermath of a future nuclear war. All these connections, their disconnections, and their relationship to the flip side of the coin made of the currency of uranium might begin with this acknowledgement with J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. "If you don't try to develop atomic energy, you can't control it," he wrote and documented in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in June 1946. Even as he was questioning the economic viability of atomic power to generate electricity. You can't say, first we will control it, and then we will develop it, because the developmental functions are an essential part of the mechanism for control. And so it is. Societies have developed it without controls. Witness this mountain of nuclear waste we are gathered to address. The control of the formulation, development, and use of this terrible and awesome energy was initially a tug of war between the military and the government. The Atomic Energy Act of 1946, also known as the McMahon Act, ultimately established government control of atomic energy through the Civilian Atomic Energy Commission, impaneled to both promote and at the same time attempt to regulate the development and management of both atomic bombs and atomic power. The Act's principal author was Senator Brien McMahon, a Democrat from Connecticut, who called the July 16, 1945 detonation of the first atomic bomb, quote, "the most important thing in history since the birth of Jesus Christ." Dying of cancer, McMahon would run for president of the United States in 1952 on a platform to ensure world peace through the fear of atomic bombs. But the firmly established connection between nuclear weapons and nuclear power comes in the language of the 1946 Act. Quote, "Subject at all times to the paramount objective of assuring the common defense and security, the development of atomic energy shall, so far as practicable, be directed through improving the public welfare, increasing the standard of living, strengthening free competition and private enterprise, and promoting world peace." Up until this point, American industry was but a hired hand in the government-controlled atomic energy program. But in June of 1950, a clear shift began. Dr. Charles Thomas, executive president of Monsanto Chemical Company, sent the first concrete proposal to the Atomic Energy Commission, stating that the time was now ripe for industry with its own capital to design, construct, and operate dual-purpose reactors for the production of both plutonium, for weaponizing our armament, and the production of electricity. Monsanto's blueprint was to use the large quantities of heat attending the production of plutonium to generate useful and profitable quantities of electricity. By October 1952, the Atomic Energy Commission's publication, Reactor Science and Technology, publicly announced that four industrial study groups had signed up for the initial dual-purpose reactor project: Monsanto and Union Electric Company, Dow Chemical Company and Detroit Edison, Commonwealth Edison Public Service Company and Argonne National Laboratory, and Pacific Gas and Electric and Bechtel. Their conclusions were that the dual-purpose reactors were technically feasible, commercially desirable, and could operate with the power credit to reduce the cost of plutonium by considerable amounts. However, all of the study groups agreed that no reactor could be constructed in the future, in the near future, that would be economic on the basis of power generation alone. Ironically, when we consider all the externalized costs of nuclear power, the same remains true today, recognized 60 years ago. It would be President Dwight Eisenhower to take up Oppenheimer's premise, however, that one must develop atomic energy to control it. He said, "The United States would seek more than the mere reduction and elimination of atomic materials for military purposes, for it is not enough to take this weapon out of the hands of soldiers. It must be put into the hands of those who will know how to strip its military casing and adapt it to the arts of peace." Under the two terms of the Eisenhower administration and the launch of Atoms for Peace, as an atomic swords into plowshares scheme, the U.S. nuclear arsenal would grow from 1,436 nuclear weapons to 20,464 weapons. Congress would amend the act in 1954, expediting the development and licensing and construction of atomic power. The Eisenhower administration not only manufactured and bought the initial public acceptance of nuclear power from the mushroom cloud, as Jonathan Schell writes, "Atoms for Peace, while providing cover for an immense increase in existing superpower arsenals, sowed the dragon's teeth for nuclear proliferation that future generations have wrestled in vain." While the U.S. atomic program would go on to develop in light water reactor technology rather than the dual-purpose reactors, principally breeders, in fact, in the United States in 1963, it would be President John F. Kennedy that would visit the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State to commemorate the site's ninth weaponized plutonium production reactor and participate in the groundbreaking ceremony for that reactor production site that would be the only dual-purpose reactor in the United States. The promotional collusion and safety negligence would catch up on the Atomic Energy Commission and result in its eventual abolition in 1975. The oversight of nuclear power and nuclear weapons was divided between the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Energy Research Development Association, later to become the Department of Energy. But it would change nothing more than the window dressing for the nuclear conundrum. Our global collective conundrum was amplified with the passage of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Nuclear Weapons Treaty attempted to control nuclear weapons by establishing the haves nations and the haves not nations, who would have nuclear weapons and nuclear power and who would only be able to develop nuclear power. It was opened in 1968 and the treaty was entered into force in 1970. It was extended indefinitely in 1995, where now we have a total of 190 signatories that have entered into the treaty. Our concern focuses on Article 4 of that NPT treaty, which establishes the inalienable right of any nation to pursue atomic energy for non-weapons purposes. In fact, Article 4 of the NPT ratified, extended, and formalized Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program and hauled the nuclear weapons Trojan horse into the non-proliferation regime. The merchandising and trafficking of nuclear weapons, as condoned under Article 4 of the NPT, has legitimized atoms for power and weapons alike. Jonathan Schell further writes on Article 4 and its dangerous contradiction within the NPT in his book, The Seventh Decade. He writes, "The nuclear powers brought the right to keep their arsenals at least temporarily. The treaty's Article 4, 6 required that they surrender them eventually by institutionalizing the spread of nuclear technology to other countries. Or to put the matter differently, the non-nuclear states won full access to nuclear power technology as the reward for renouncing nuclear weapons in a world in which five possessors were permitted to keep theirs. The deal was a Trojan horse written into the text of the treaty. Continued possession by the five assured that in the many other countries, the desire to obtain nuclear weapons would be strong, while Article 4's provisions assured that they would legally be able to acquire 9/10 of the wherewithal to fulfill their ambitions." The history also provides a very vivid number of missed opportunities. In 1949, Secretary of Interior Julius Krug expressed his interest in solar power in a speech on conservation given at the United Nations. His successor, Oscar Chapman, discussed with the National Academy of Sciences the possibility of commissioning a solar energy study. The Korean War intervened in the meantime, but by 1951, President Harry Truman had convened what was called the Materials Policy Commission under the direction of William S. Paley. In July 1952, the Paley Commission published Resources for Freedom, a report to the president, and the whole idea that the report gave a very relatively pessimistic assessment of nuclear power and called for aggressive research in the whole field of solar energy. The Paley Commission wrote, quote, "Nuclear fuels, for various technical reasons, are unlikely ever to bear more than 1/5 of the load." Curiously, that's 20% of where we are now in 2012. "We must look to solar. Efforts made to date to harness solar energy economically are infinitesimal. It's time for aggressive research in the whole field of solar energy, an effort in which the U.S. could make an immense contribution to the welfare of the world." The U.S., however, had arrived at a crossroads in 1952, as we know, when President Truman's Blue Ribbon Commission on Energy and Material Resources basically concluded that nuclear power was only a modest fraction of American energy requirements at best, and strongly recommend that we move into solar and renewables. And we took the wrong road. Incoming President Eisenhower, however, basically, you know, killed our chances for worldwide preeminence in renewable energy. And now we come to the, you know, our present opportunity to come into a 21st century energy policy, recognizing the mistakes of the 20th century. I think that it's important that as we consider our actions, it's clear that the path is towards abandoning nuclear power. But we're not left with that same option for the oversight. Our task is that we need to have a vigorous reformation of the oversight of the waste, the reactor sites that must then be responsibly decommissioned. But we have a ways to go before that is arrived. Right now we're faced with this whole issue of What NRC really stands for is nuclear regulatory capture. And that is condoned by the political capture of Capitol Hill and the White House by the nuclear industry. And in closing, if I was to suggest one action, I would direct you to our website, www.beyondnuclear.org. Go to the Japan page. And there at the top of the page are two petitions that are put together by and endorsed by the World Network for Saving the Children from Radiation. I think that Akiko's presentation is hopeful but heart-rending that we, you know, hundreds of thousands of children don't play outside, and their future health is uncertain by the advent of the Fukushima disaster. And it's very simple for us to simply sign a petition that would, one, call upon the Japan government to begin an evacuation of children from the contaminated site, and two, it would begin a process of accountability through the Justice Department in Japan to hold those responsible for this accident to accountability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Bob Alvarez is up next, and we're aware that this is the siesta hour, and the room is warm, so be sure to stand, stretch as you need to, because this is we want you to be awake for the question and answer period. Thank you.
While this the slides get put up, before I came here, my wife Kitty cheekily asked me, "What will you be talking about, Bob?" I said, "Well, about nuclear waste." She said, "Well, is this a four-day event?" I said, "Well, no, I'm just going to talk about military nuclear waste." She said, "Oh, a two-day event." Well, give them a short time frame, as they say on the airplane, buckle your seatbelts and put your trays up. Here we go. Okay, I'm going to cover military nuclear waste in the United States, and given the short time, just bear with me, and maybe I'll try to answer some of your questions as I sort of zip through this. A lot of this was explained by Paul. As you know, in December of 1942, the actual concept of a sustained chain reaction using slow neutrons in a reactor was demonstrated underneath the Staggs Field at Chicago, University of Chicago, and in January of 1943, the Hanford site was immediately chosen, and the B reactor was built. The first uranium enrichment plant, the Calutron, was built at Y-12, and I won't dwell on this because it's been covered quite a bit. Between 1940 and 1990, research, development, testing, and production of nuclear weapons at thousands of sites in nearly every state, as well as Puerto Rico, Marshall Islands, Johnson Atoll, and the Christmas Islands in the Pacific. The total estimated cost, thanks to the good work of Steve Schwartz and his project at Brookings in 1996, pegged the estimated cost for nuclear weapons between 1940 and 1996 to $5.8 trillion. This is the first real, I think, example of the government exposing the American public to large amounts of radioactive waste in order to prosecute the nuclear arms race and to develop nuclear weapons, which was atmospheric testing in the Nevada test site. This was a study that was suppressed for 5 years by the National Cancer Institute. When I was working in the Department of Energy, I found out about this as it was suppressed and brought it to the attention of the Secretary of Energy, and my memo was leaked to the New York Times, which became what they call a career-limiting gesture, and I went into a political rehabilitation for about a year where they sent me out to Hanford. What this basic map tells you is that radioactive fallout created such severe contamination in areas of milk, particularly the milk supply of the American public, at a time when people of my generation, the large baby boom generation, were growing up, that there were areas where if they had protective action guides that are in place right now for nuclear accidents, milk would have had been withdrawn from the market for periods of months at a time, year in, year out, especially during the first part of the year. This was 150 million curies of radioiodine were just released all over the United States in order to pursue nuclear weapons. The United States stopped blowing up bombs in Nevada in the early 60s. This is, in a nutshell, what I'm going to talk about. These are just what we know, and I largely put this together in the mid-1990s when I worked for the Department of Energy because no one had rolled it up before, but this is sort of what the picture looks like in terms of the magnitude of the waste that have been generated. It's quite a lot, and you can sort of see for yourself. The single biggest amount of radioactive waste is clearly from the mining of uranium. And the enrichment of uranium. There's no question in terms of volume. In terms of concentration and radioactivity, it's high-level radioactive waste. And in terms of radiotoxicity, it is really the transuranic waste, the wastes that are essentially dominated by plutonium contamination. Those are sort of a way to think about this. But the nuclear weapons complex, what's left of it and its remaining sort of antiquated infrastructure, is the largest government-owned enterprise in the United States. If it were on the Fortune 500, it would probably rank around 30, 35. If it were really on the Fortune 500, it would be in Chapter 7. Let's talk about what is the Energy Department. What you see here is less than 20% of the Energy Department's budget is actually dedicated to energy, actual real energy activities. You see that nearly two-thirds of the budget deals with military nuclear activities, predominantly nuclear weapons, which is the single biggest aspect of it, and non-proliferation, which is a rather small fraction of that. Naval reactors is another small fraction, and nuclear site cleanup, which is about $6 billion a year. The Department of Energy has a giant millstone around its neck. In the form of its maintaining a large, antiquated nuclear infrastructure and having to clean up the mess that's been created by it. And I doubt that we'll have any real meaningful energy policy in this country, at least coming at the federal level, as long as we have an energy department that's structured like that. Because any energy secretary who comes in, having worked in the DOE for six very long years, immediately finds themselves in budgetary handcuffs. Immediately. And those functions there, that $5.78 billion, you can pay, knock off about $1.2 billion of that, and that's for nuclear R&D. So it is basically what we have is a nuclear tail wagging our energy policy dog in terms of the nature of our policy function. The DOE spends 10 times more on military nuclear activities than on energy conservation. This is our energy department. This is what we call an energy department. Just to walk you through the waste, uranium mining and milling waste are, as I said, the largest single volume. There are, as was pointed out by the previous speaker from the Lakota, there are thousands of abandoned mines that have been totally neglected, and that the people who are suffering the most from this are Native people, Indigenous people, who have to bear the brunt of the contamination. The EPA has long known, and so has the Energy Department, that Native people, Indigenous people, are the most vulnerable to environmental contaminants, period, and have done virtually nothing to remediate this huge injustice. Uranium mill tailings generated approximately 25 million tons. We did establish a program in 1978, which I was involved with back when I was in a previous incarnation throwing spears. And it basically has done some reasonable remediation, at least in capping and controlling the spread of the contamination from the mills themselves. From the 1940s to 1970, nuclear weapons wastes at sites were basically the fundamental operation of these weapons sites was that they used the environment they occupied as disposal and storage media for some of the world's largest, most dangerous materials. In order to make the most dangerous weapons in the world, they had to use and generate some of the most dangerous materials in the world and use these large land sites as disposal sites. At Hanford, for example, I point out that more than 400 billion gallons of contaminated liquids were dumped directly into the ground there. That's roughly enough to create a poisonous lake the size of Manhattan, more than 80 feet deep. And these are the legacies that we have. It was only in 1970 that the Atomic Energy Commission began to establish and formalize a system of classification of waste disposal. And this is where we first heard the terms high-level radioactive waste and transuranic waste. And this is the underlying definition of now what we call the definition of high-level waste under the 1982 Nuclear Waste Policy Act, which hopefully we'll have some time to talk about, which is effectively collapsed now. They also decided that transuranic waste could no longer be just dumped into the ground. The radiotoxicity of plutonium is quite significant. It has a very long half-life. It's about 20 times more radiotoxic than, let's say, cesium-137. And in larger amounts, of course, in terms it can be used to fuel nuclear weapons. The United States has the world's largest inventory of depleted uranium. It's about 732,000 metric tons of depleted uranium. A very, very tiny fraction of this was used in weapons. Somewhere around the order of 2,000 to 3,000 tons was used actually in armaments and projectiles and armor. Most of it is in this form, sitting in these canisters. They're about as big as Toyota pickup trucks. There are about 13,000 of them. 55,000 of them sitting in these canisters in the form of unstable gas, uranium hexafluoride. These are the byproducts of the gaseous diffusion plants that enriched uranium primarily for nuclear weapons and then subsequently for nuclear power plants at three locations in Paducah, Kentucky, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Portsmouth, Ohio. And we're now just starting to defluorinate these canisters to generate yet another very large amount of depleted uranium and oxide that would probably, once that's done, the DU waste itself will probably fill the equivalent of 2 to 3 Empire State Buildings. Transuranic waste, I mentioned. Transuranics are basically elements that are heavier than uranium. The transuranic wastes are the dominant radionuclide in transuranic wastes, or the actinide, is plutonium-239. And it's the dominant not only in terms of the quantity, but its toxicity. And you notice that Hanford has about 60% of the volume of all transuranic wastes. Idaho has the largest concentration. Before 1970, they just dumped it into the ground. And at Hanford, there's about 2 metric tons of plutonium just dumped into shallow land burial in the 200 West area, which is roughly enough to fuel about 8,000 nuclear weapons. The Department of Energy has no intention whatsoever of removing this. If you think about what is the ultimate danger of high-level radioactive waste in terms of radiotoxicity, it's the plutonium, stupid. When all is said and done, when all those other radioactive materials decay away after several hundreds of years or thousands of years, this is the stuff you have to worry about from the point of view of the human environment. And yet, we have an agency that is setting the stage to walk away from this awful, terrible outrage on the environment. The other part of this is that in 1970, the first deep geologic long-term repository was proposed, a waste isolation pilot project in New Mexico, and it was finally opened in 1999. And it has now been receiving and disposing, and we have been disposing of a very large quantity of plutonium-contaminated waste or transuranic waste. We have nearly 8 metric tons of plutonium in that repository. About 3.5 metric tons were actually set aside for nuclear weapons. This was nuclear weapons material that we had no use for, so we blended it down and put it into this deep geologic repository. The Waste Isolation Pilot Project is now being eyed by Congress and DOE for disposal of military high-level waste and other excess plutonium. Buckle your seatbelts on that one. High-level radioactive waste were generated primarily until the nuclear power industry started to take off in the 1970s by the nuclear weapons program. And it was mainly in the form of reprocessed waste, where they would separate irradiated uranium and extract the uranium and plutonium and then leave behind the waste in a liquid form that were neutralized. The waste came out as an acid. During World War II, there was a shortage of stainless steel, so they built, they worked around it. This was the DuPont Corporation, and added sodium hydroxide, or lye, to neutralize the waste, and then put them in these tanks, which are larger than most state capital domes. These are 500,000 to a million gallon tanks. There are 200 of these tanks in the DOE nuclear weapons complex, holding about 100 million gallons. More than a third of them have leaked. And these are the wastes that truly threaten very important regional water supplies, such as the Columbia River, the Snake River aquifer, the Tuscaloosa Formation, which is the primary drinking water aquifer, the southeastern coastal plain of the United States. This is the real serious stuff. This is just a visualization of what Hanford waste is about and what I mean to say by neutralized waste. The wastes are essentially inhomogeneous. They're basically broken up into soluble and insoluble wastes, and the salt and the liquids are soluble. And the sludge, it was at the bottom of the tanks, insoluble, and this is how the radioactivity is distributed. It's turning into a real nightmare to remove and to process these wastes. This is the sort of just a graph of the summary of the radioactivity. This is roughly on the order of 10 times less radioactivity that's been generated by our commercial nuclear power fleet. So there's about 10 times more radioactivity in spent fuel at commercial nuclear power plants than there is in defense high-level waste. But it's been real problematic. We've spent about $120 billion and have been able to process less than 5% of these wastes over the last 30 years. It's really turning into a very difficult and daunting challenge. Underground tests, 300 million curies sitting underneath the test site from blowing off more than 1,000 shots. I'm just putting this up as a recovering bureaucrat. But this is really what it looks like when you see, one of the big challenges that no one really talks about is physically eliminating nuclear weapons. Getting rid of them physically so that especially the material that is used to fuel them will never, ever be used again. This is what it's going to take. This is what it looks like in terms of how it works inside the Energy Department. I don't mean to dwell on this, and I'm not going to walk you through it. It's very complicated. It's very difficult. It's very expensive and very daunting, and it is at the lowest priority within the Department of Energy at this time. The Department of Energy, United States has a nuclear arsenal of which 40% of it has been discarded by the military, and those warheads remain intact. And that we are cutting back on our dismantlement fundings while we're increasing our funding to essentially keep these this old, aging, oversized, grotesquely oversized nuclear arsenal modernized and refurbished. That's another my example of outrage. Excess plutonium, there's about 42.3 metric tons that have been generated, about 34 metric tons from weapons, and it's a real daunting challenge. Uranium-233, I just threw this in because I recently did a report about this. This is another example of the Department of Energy trying to take a shortcut. This is a cautionary tale about the thorium fuel cycle. This is the stuff that's produced when you irradiate thorium. It costs about $11 billion to produce 2 metric tons of thorium in the United States. And it turned out to be a bust, and now they don't want to spend $1 million a kilogram to blend it down and are trying to dump a big portion of it at 86% concentration in shallow land burial in the Nevada deserts. This gives you an idea of what the costs look like right now. According to DOE, these are lowball estimates because they really don't include the full costs that are entailed, but you see Hanford is really head and shoulders above everything. This is what I've concluded. Nuclear weapons production has resulted in the most expensive, complex, and risky environmental cleanup challenge in the United States. The U.S. nuclear weapons program is responsible for the greatest exposure to ionizing radiations workers in the public. You can talk about your nuclear power plants, your emissions from nuclear power plants, but it's the bomb program that has caused far more radiation exposure to the public and commercial nukes right now. The volume and types of nuclear waste are greater than those generated by commercial nuclear power plants, although with the caveat, the concentration of high-level radioactive waste in nuclear power plants are enormously large and dwarf those of the weapons program. Nuclear weapons production has created national sacrifice zones of profound contamination. There are large lake beds in the Watts Bar Reservoir where there are 67 metric tons of mercury sitting in the sediments. We have huge areas which we haven't a clue what we're going to do with. We're going to have to cordon off for periods of time to transcend human history. And our nuclear weapons program is well on a path of leaving almost the most dangerous of their wastes behind in shallow land burial, and no one's raising a fuss about this. And the physical elimination of nuclear weapons has a very low priority in the United States. What should we do about this? I just want to warn you that the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, which has established the framework for the disposal of these most dangerous wastes, both in terms of military and civilian waste, spent fuel from power reactors and reprocessing waste from nuclear weapons production. The framework is basically collapsed, and that this law is going to be reopened starting next year. You better start paying attention to this, because these are kind of decisions that are going to affect an entire generation of people in this country in terms of the fate and disposition of spent fuel at those power plants in this state and elsewhere, as well as the nuclear weapon sites across the United States. From the point of view of looking at the nuclear weapon side of this thing, I think there's going to be a major effort by the Department of Energy to redefine the definition of high-level radioactive waste to leave behind some of the most dangerous nuclear materials in the world. And we need to fight this, and you guys need to get ready and start to become smart about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can read much of what Bob Alvarez, some of what Bob Alvarez has thought about in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, I'm very proud to say. And you can find much at our website, www.thebulletin.org. It's my pleasure now to turn to Kendra for the final panel presentation. And I hope you look pretty awake. That's good. I'm delighted. So then we'll turn to the questions and further discussion.
Before I get started, I want to discuss a little bit about putting this into cultural and political context. But before I get started, I'm going to ask for your active participation for about 2 minutes, just to get a feel for who's in the room today. So if you've been working on this issue, on nuclear weapons or nuclear energy, before Chernobyl, could you please stand up? That's a lot of people. And if you were activated, nope, keep standing, stand, thank you. If you were activated by Chernobyl and you got involved immediately in the aftermath of Chernobyl, could you also stand up? Great. And for those of you that were activated by Fukushima and became activated after that, could you please stand up? Great. And for those of you that this is a brand new issue and you're just getting used to this, could you please stand up? Great. Lots of you in the room. Great. I want to thank all of you for the work that you're doing, because we wouldn't be able to move to a nuclear-free future without all of you being active and engaged, and particularly those that have been active on this issue for decades. A very special thanks to you. We've made a lot of progress. At one time, Nixon promised 1,000 nuclear reactors by 2000. We have 104 operating, with one about to be shut down next year. So thank you. So big round of applause for those folks that did that work. Great. Thank you so much. So I just want to talk very, very briefly, and Bob and Paul did an excellent job discussing these issues, so I won't dwell too long on the history of the nuclear age. This is one of my favorite quotes, that the nuclear arms race is like two sworn enemies standing waist deep in gasoline, one with five matches and one with three. I think that pretty much sums up what it means to have a nuclear bomb arsenal in our country and elsewhere. Paul really highlighted the issue with the Atoms for Peace program, that this was a program that really diverted attention of the public from the buildup of a nuclear weapons arsenal. One thing I just want to draw attention to as well is that not only were we building up the nuclear arsenal, but the sharing of nuclear technology with other countries enabled them to acquire the bomb as well, and I'll go into that a little bit more later. So peaceful nuclear technology is a myth. It is something that has been fabricated to put a happy face on the atom. And it's something that we cannot buy into because this has very real implications for today. Right now, just the political realities of where we're at right now, the Atoms for Peace program told us that international prosperity could be assured by sharing peaceful nuclear technology. Today, we're being told that it is the solution to global warming. Arjun did a very good job of explaining why it is not the solution to global warming earlier, so I won't delve into that too much, that it is the path to U.S. energy independence. Also a lie. We are sourcing most of our uranium today from foreign countries. It is a finite resource, just like coal or any other fossil fuel, and it won't last forever. Our president, just so we're all very, you know, being very realistic and not looking at this with rose-colored glasses, our president is very much pro-nuclear. So this is a political obstacle that we need to be aware of as we move forward into the next 4 years. The sharing of nuclear technology, though, necessarily helps other countries to get the nuclear bomb. So this was a really interesting study that was done by a political scientist, Furman, who did a very in-depth statistical analysis of what the intrinsic connection is between getting nuclear assistance, civilian nuclear assistance, and starting a weapons program. What he found was that participation in a nuclear cooperation agreement, that means a country that doesn't have nuclear technology, signing or getting into a treaty with a country that does in order to share that technology, increased the likelihood of starting a weapons program by 500%. In the event that that country was experiencing conflict at the time, was in a conflicted area of the world, it increased the likelihood of starting a nuclear weapons program by 638%. Between 1955 and 2000, no country started a weapons program without first entering into a nuclear cooperation agreement. And if they were in a nuclear cooperation agreement, actually acquiring the bomb, being successful, increased by 360%, as well as the combination of atomic assistance and conflict, increased the likelihood by 750% of actually getting the bomb. Now, today, the countries that have expressed an interest in entering into these kinds of agreements are in very conflicted areas of the world. So we're talking about countries like Jordan, Libya, but that was kind of before the crisis that was happening there, Qatar, the UAE, and Vietnam. In 2009, President Obama introduced amendments to the Atomic Energy Act that allowed us to share nuclear technology with the UAE. Now, this is a country that is situated directly across the Persian Gulf from the rogue nuclear state of Iran. So these are very real political issues that we need to be thinking about as we're moving forward into what kind of energy systems do we want to be supporting and what kind of world do we want to be creating. So cultural obstacles. How many are familiar with the term nuke speak? Beautiful. Okay. What this is, and if you've ever been to an NRC meeting, you've seen this. If you've ever sat in with a nuclear operator in any kind of meeting, you've seen this. This is the use of technical jargon and euphemism that fundamentally undermines public discourse about these issues. And essentially what it is saying is that the public is too stupid to understand what the risks are, that they're hysterical, that they are fear-mongering, And that really, nuclear energy is a positive. It's the way forward, again, you know, presenting it in that positive light in a way that it becomes the privileged argument. And it fundamentally undermines the other discourses that we need to be having, like ionizing radiation and what impacts it has. Like all of the things that Bob just brought up, the extensive contamination, the uranium tailing sites that are still unremediated on Navajo lands today, all of these other discourses about what the actual ecological and human health costs are completely undermined by the use of this. Now, I want us to be really cognizant of this as well, because what ends up happening is that anti-nuclear activists that I've seen quite a bit end up using the same kind of jargon as the people that were, you know, working to really show the truth of what they're saying, to show the truth behind what they're saying. So I've seen shareable images on Facebook that talk about millirems. That's really great if you want to just talk to the people in this room that have been working on this for four decades. But no one else knows what you're talking about. So it's really, really important that when we start, Bob said earlier on the panel this morning, these communities frequently are experiencing extremely high poverty rates. And by going in there and trying to offer them millions of dollars, that's bribery for accepting a toxic trade. And Paul touched on this as well, regulatory capture. So the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is the only agency that's allowed to regulate safety. And they are one of the most captured regulatory bodies. So this also is a massive obstacle for us moving forward. And I will get to what we can do on the positive side in a minute. So, not really rocket science here. We have to stop creating the problem. We have got to stop generating more nuclear waste. We are perpetuating a problem that represents intergenerational oppression, that we are handing a toxic legacy to the next 1,000 generations. And we have to stop, and we need to stop it now. Now, one of the Achilles heels of the nuclear industry is the economics. It does not function in a free market. It requires massive subsidies and massive indemnification against risk in order to make nuclear energy even somewhat economically viable. And even now, it's falling prey to energy markets that make it non-competitive. But we also need to be careful about that, because what our vision is sustainability, is a future we want to give to our children. One of the things that's making nuclear uneconomical is natural gas. And I think most people in this room are pretty well aware of fracking, et cetera. That's not the future that we want to be handing to our children. So I just wanted to talk very, very briefly about Vermont. Vermont is doing some excellent work, feed-in tariffs, supporting community-based energy sources through their SPEED program. 11% of their portfolio, if they counted it as a resource, would be energy efficiency, which is very exciting. And moving forward, so what I'm going to ask you to do, and you don't have to do it right now, but I want you to think about it. There are so many people on the Hill that are completely and totally unaware of the intrinsic link between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. So what I'm going to ask you to do is write a letter to your member of Congress, to your senators, asking them to address this issue, expressing your concern that the waste can be mined for the plutonium-239, that these represent a very real proliferation risk, and that we absolutely have to stop. And if you don't know, you can go to these websites, and I can leave this up later so you can see it, but I've only got a couple more minutes, so... And then I want you, before you send that letter, to get at least one other person who doesn't know about this issue to write one too. So I'm going to ask you all to make the commitment to get one other person to write a letter expressing concern. And what that does is it makes sure there's a staff person that's going to read that letter. They're going to have to do research on the issue in order to reply to it. They might talk to their boss about that issue. And that is the way that we start generating that kind of discourse. And then I want you to think creatively, because we've got a new Congress starting in January. We're going to have a lot of state legislative sessions. Some of the things that we can start supporting in our own states, and I totally agree with Arjun, that really where we're going to make inroads is at the state level first, is getting those feed-in tariff laws passed, is getting support for renewables, really working with your state utility boards to make sure that those programs are supported and that they're funded. And then you've got nonviolent direct action. Kinnett had mentioned earlier that, Vermont Yankee's not quite shut down there. However, there is one of the most vibrant nonviolent direct action campaigns, and it's growing, and it's an inspiring movement of people getting together to really resist this very, very captured regulatory agency and a political and legal system that undermines citizen empowerment.
If you could direct your question to one of the panelists, I think that would be a quick and efficient way. I know don't always have to be efficient, but yes, step up to the microphone. And would you say your name and your affiliation?
Dr. Laura Chamberlain from Nuclear Free Illinois and NAIS. To all of you, are your presentations up on your website? Because that would really help us.
I think it would be useful if David Kraft could put it up on the NEIS site. Yeah. David?
Great. Yeah, we'll put it up on the that bottom one, nukefree.foe.org.
We could put it up on the IPS and the NEIS. I think that's a great idea. Thank you. Yes.
Hi,
next.
I'm Bob Backus from New Hampshire. And I certainly want to endorse what Arjun said and our last speaker said, the states are the place to take action. Very nice to write your members of Congress. We don't have the money. Congress responds to the money. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anything's going to change at the NRC until Congress changes, and I just don't see that happening. With this exception, one place that Congress is worried about is the budget right now. Mm-hmm. Stop the subsidies. Yeah. That's the thing to do in Congress.
Agreed.
Stop the subsidies. And in the states, stop the ratepayer bailouts, the QIP. That's the big fight. Stop the new reactors, and they're vulnerable. I'd say don't spend your time on interventions and licensing extension proceedings. That's the NRC. They're always going to rule against you. You can have a lot of fun doing it. It's not effective. But fight the new reactors, and that's the way to do it. Economics is not one of the problems with nuclear. It's their biggest problem. And if we can keep the ratepayer and the taxpayer subsidies from coming to them, they're done.
Great. Thank you very much.
Ms. Benedict, I don't know if you were with the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, Peace and International Security Policy Making Division. When I won my grant, I got the notice of it in 90 and got the money in 91. So if you administered that grant, I want to thank you. Hallelujah. Thank you so much, ma'am. I am so grateful to you. I was down in my last quarter, and it was borrowed. So thank you. And Bob Alvarez, with great respect, you know I've known you for some 30 years, but I want to ask you if you could address the permitting process by which the Nevada test site, for instance, operates under the auspices of the Department of Energy, and something I'd rather call the Department of Evil rather than the DOE. And let's also call the Department of Defense the Department of Death and get it over with. But, sir, do you have any background information as to what's going on at the Nevada test site? I'm sure you're aware of this, a whole new era of weaponry is in production there with subsequent waste materials, and I don't know if you can speak of these things. You may remember Divine Strake. You know, I was a litigant to stop that business. Can you mention any of this, or are you still...
Thank you. Yeah,
is
thank
your mouth
you.
Still shut on that?
Bob, do you want to say anything?
I think the Nevada Nuclear Weapons Test Site, which is essentially land that's under control of the federal government, and I just subsequently learned that they also bought out the groundwater rights from the state. I don't know what all the things they're trying to do, but I think that the inability to do underground weapons testing is a fundamentally huge blow to the nuclear weapons R&D establishment, and they can do all these different simulations and tests and things like that, but I tend to think that what we're looking at is the end of that era and having to clean up after the parade.
Okay, good, thank you. Next.
Hi, my name is Sabrina Maniotis, and I'm with the West Side Greens and Chicago Indie Media. I have heard from a lot of educated young people, including my 23-year-old son, that say, all you gray hairs are, you're old school, and that you're not with it, that the new idea is that, and this is what my son says, to use liquid fluoride thorium reactors, and that there's very little waste, that you can turn the switch off, they don't have to be cooled, and this is the answer that will go between the nuclear age to renewables. We can't.
Well, this is the kind of logic where if it's on the internet, it must be true. And that I spoke very, very briefly about when I mentioned uranium-233. Well, uranium-233 is the product of the thorium fuel cycle. The United States effectively broke its pick on trying to develop those types of fuel using that specific type of technology. In a way, the thorium cult, if you were to liken them to the Roman Catholic Church, are kind of like the Jesuits. They're the most militant and crazed about this, and they are the most sort of... But the thing about this stuff is that you should reply to your son, it's very an interesting idea until you start to think about it.
Thank you.
And by the way, I have a paper coming out in Science and Global Security about, it's called Management of the Uranium-233 Stockpile, that sort of is a cautionary tale about the U.S. experience with the thorium fuel cycle. And I also have an earlier version of that report on the IPS website. It was also reported in the New York Times on September 23rd of this year.
Okay, good.
And just to make it clear, uranium-233 is weapons grade.
Good. I think what I'll do, there is a very long line of people wanting to ask questions. Could I ask that we take two comments, questions at a time, and then ask the panel to respond? Thank you.
Well, I actually have two separate things really quick, because there's two areas that I haven't seen on the program, and I want to make sure they get addressed somewhere, if not now, later today. It's the MOX program. I believe some of the Rocky Flats plutonium ended up in my state of South Carolina at the under construction MOX facility, which is another, I think, crossing gray area between commercial and weapons, because they're trying to build this plant to burn this MOX fuel to go where we don't know. And I'm just curious if y'all have any comments about that. And the other thing that I haven't seen on the agenda here is this idea of bringing all the spent fuel to a DOE site, which my state is in the crosshairs of dumping this 70,000 tons plus whatever else is being created at a central location, which when I saw the graph with the Savannah River site and all the radiation, I'm like, well, that just puts it over the top there, doesn't it? So I wondered if they would speak about either one of those or both.
Yeah, thanks. Bob, do you want to talk about MOX?
Well, yeah, sure. The mixed oxide program is essentially a program to try to mix plutonium from nuclear weapons with uranium to fuel commercial nuclear power plants. It's estimated to cost, at least in terms of construction, about $5 billion. And if you look at the M&O management operating costs or life cycle costs, it's probably going to be 4 to 5 times more than that. The timing of this facility is such as by the time that any large quantity of MOX material will be available for nuclear power plants, assuming they can overcome certain safety problems, which are not minor, a lot of these power plants will be closed. The thing about MOX is that it makes the spent fuel much, much more radioactive. And you can't recycle this stuff, despite what the French say. They only do it once through. Once you start to use large amounts of plutonium or any significant amount of plutonium in a commercial reactor, you're not burning up that much. You're burning up about 20% of it, and the rest of it remains. But what happens is that it renders the spent fuel fantastically more radioactive and gives off a greater amount of what they call decay heat. And the decay heat is so great that in some instances, this stuff will have to cool off for 150 years before you can even think about putting it into a geologic repository.
Thanks. Could I
could, did you want to talk about DOE repository sites?
Well, there's only one. It's the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, right. And that this is currently receiving and disposing of transuranic waste. Although I think it's going to be a candidate for disposal of military high-level radioactive waste in the future.
Okay, good, thanks. I am, in the interest of time, going to ask that the man in the blue shirt be the last person to ask questions, so no more new people in the line. And I thought the gentleman in the yellow shirt.
Well, my friends let me up.
Okay.
My friends let me up.
All right.
Because I'm on the same vein as Susan, and we need to finish this. So, Bob, I should have said hello this morning. I'm sure you would have covered MOX more thoroughly instead of glossing over it. So this is what we're living with in South Carolina and Georgia. And we're spending $500 million a year. All the plutonium is coming back to Savannah River site on the Savannah River. And we have no customers for this boondoggle. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to be opposed to this MOX plutonium fuel, but we have no customers. TVA is a federal, quasi-federal agency, and they got forced into the tritium program, and I think that's DOE's plan now, is to force them to take MOX. But even if that happened, they're facing 10 years of licensing and testing, and they've got like a 40-year-old Fukushima-style reactor and a nearly that old ice condenser dismal reactor. So I just want everybody to know this, and that there's a really campaign that's growing legs with the budget. People are figuring out this is the factory to nowhere.
Thanks.
So you may want to comment on that, yeah. But my other little piece is to add on to what Susan said. She did not mention that the state of South Carolina has asked for all the spent fuel to come. I mean, this is a work in progress that Savannah River Site in South Carolina is saying, yucca failed, bring it here. So y'all, South Carolina is poised to be the new yucca, and we desperately hope and believe that the same national energy will prevent that from happening, and what Bob pointed out is coming down the pike. We got
thank
to redo
you.
Our
thank
nuclear
you.
Program.
Thank you very much. We're really pleased to hear about that, and thank you for sharing all the details. Now, next.
My name is Eric Levins. I'm from Tennessee, born in Oak Ridge, but now living in Ray County, the site of Watts Bar, one of the only two reactors currently under construction in this country. And for the past several years, I've been working predominantly on the mountaintop removal coal mining issue that's destroying mountains in Appalachia, and a big part of what I've been doing is traveling around doing educational presentations about it and trying to get more people involved. And I'm working right now on a presentation to look at the parallels between the coal and nuclear issues to bring that around predominantly in the Southeast next year. I've also been heavily involved in direct action and civil disobedience on the issue, and we've been working on trying to build bridges with the folks fighting hydrofracking as well as the folks fighting nukes. And so I guess my question was going to be for Paul, since you're with the Clamshell Alliance, but also Kendra, since you mentioned direct action. If you want to respond, that would be great. I'm just wondering, like, if y'all have ideas about what it's going to take to get thousands of people coming together, risking arrest to get in the way of what's happening right now.
Thanks very much. Can I take the next person, and then we'll get reactions from and responses from all of you?
Actually, my name is Robert Chavez, a member of Think Outside the Bomb and Honor Our Public Existence. I actually don't have a question as much as I do have a comment. Mm-hmm. One of the comments I wanted to make was on the MOX fuel. It involves my community, Los Alamos. They want to do is they want to bring 13 metric tons of the plutonium, and they want to convert it into this MOX fuel via the Ares process. So they want to take a plutonium pit and basically chop it in half, and through the Ares project, turn it into plutonium oxide and mix it with uranium oxide to create these eraser-sized pellets of fuel. And, you know, I really don't want that to happen. And the second point I wanted to make was on the waste isolation plant. It's the only geological repository in the Department of Energy. And by law, it's limited to 175,000 cubic feet of transuranic waste. And the waste that you're talking about, the energy waste, is only 2 metric tons of activated metals. And that is 160 million curies of radiation. The 175,000 pounds limited by law is only 3 million curies of radiation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to get an idea of the problem that we're facing.
Thank you very much. Would you like to respond to the issues of coalitions with other groups? Okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm. And direct action.
Well, I would respond that even, you know, at one point we had
during the Clamshell Alliance. And again, we're talking past tense here, okay? Let's be clear. There is a legacy, but the organization basically ceased with the operation of Unit 1. Unit 2 was canceled, but I think that was more a message that public mobilization, principled action, that spread over the country. And we have that as this legacy. But in the beginning, it was really, 18 people and 250 in support. So I think that the steps to mass mobilization begin with acts of individuals collectively acting together, and that you have to act on principle that, this is your commitment. And so, but I would say that that's greatly enhanced by reading the works of people like Gene Sharp, who's well published on how mass public mobilization, principled action, nonviolent civil disobedience, that's been a formula that's been a part of social change in current history in many issues beyond energy. So I think those are good steps. But don't expect that to happen overnight. And, it won't happen unless we as individuals take those first initial steps.
Kendra, would you like to add anything to that?
I think you about covered it.
Okay. All right, good, thanks. Yeah, next.
Yeah, a couple of quick questions. One is...
Could you bring the microphone down and identify
thanks.
Yourself
Barbara
as well?
Barbara Wimsatt.
Thank you.
One question I have is about the Great Lakes, which is 20% of the world's fresh water, and it's ringed by nuclear power plants. I think that's a disturbing situation, and I'm also wondering what effect it's having on the water, and potentially. Second thing is mostly a remark, and that is when I look around this room, many of the people have gray hair, like me. And I'm wondering, where are the young people who should be involved in this? It's their future. And I think they're over listening to talks about Kuhn.
Yeah, well.
We need a revolution.
That's, yeah, right. Yeah. Next, please. Thank you.
Oh, we're taking two questions.
Jake Aronov, I'm here in Chicago, Nuclear Energy Information Service et al. I wear different hats. I'm 57 years old. I guess I'm not, from this crowd here, I'm not old enough, so I'm going to start dyeing my hair gray. Couple of questions. First to Paul Ginter, if I'm pronouncing your name right, sorry. You mentioned the Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that is a very problematic. I see it as problematic. Pakistan had nuclear reactors before they got the bomb. We're concerned about Iran. Iran has long had a nuclear power program, and now we're the last 10 years we're threatening to invade them in order to stop them from getting the bomb. And lastly, Israel has long had nuclear weapons. As far as I know, they've never had a nuclear power program. My question is, how do you strengthen the non-proliferation treaty in order to discourage countries from getting nuclear power and nuclear weapons? And my other question is to Bob Alvarez. What was my question here? Sorry for a minute.
Well, maybe you can ask him later at the break. Yes. We're going to go to a break
right.
in a minute. So let me turn to ask about the effects on water was the first question. Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well, I think it's important to understand, first of all, that given that nuclear power is a lot like cutting butter with a chainsaw, that is that you've got only 33% of the energy generated in the fission process actually going to turbines. The rest of, the principle is waste heat. And so every nuclear power plant requires tremendous amounts of water. The Oyster Creek nuclear power plant on Barnegat Bay in New Jersey takes in on the order of 1.5 billion gallons of water a day. It basically recycles Barnegat Bay through its cooling system, thousands of times every year. And with those tremendous intake, that tremendous discharge of thermal pollution, there is always the fact that the piping systems in these nuclear power plants are deteriorating, and with that deterioration, we see accelerated leakage. And then there's also the deliberate venting. So you have this, basically sieves that are being created for all the isotopes that are generated in and leaking out of the fuel and eventually getting into the water. There is, the only way to address that is to shut these things down. That is the principal and quick route to go. As far as the NPT,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's get the Trojan horse out of the act. Let's basically get Article 4 closed.
Okay.
That's the principle.
Okay, thank you. And could I turn then to the woman?
That's not easy, but
yeah.
That's the
yeah.
answer.
Could
Why
I
beat around the bush?
I'm sorry. The woman in green, I'm sorry. I need to do the last two. You're standing between everyone and their break. And
the
I'm
name is
Helnauska
Gittler.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say that what about the countries that, Germany and Poland, Eastern European countries who do not have nuclear power plants? Can we learn from them? Geothermal power, the statistics there, how are they faring compared to, make comparisons, start learning from them, the geothermal power, alternatives, etc. So you have any statistics on that?
Thanks very much. In fact, just to put a plug in for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, you'll find in our recent issue, the whole issue is devoted to Germany's nuclear exit, several articles about how they're doing it and with what success. But would you like to... I'm sorry, I have one more question.
Well, I had one more answer.
We
had skipped over the question about young people.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And generating...
Yes. I thought it was a rhetorical
involvement
question.
Involvement of young people.
Sorry.
So I just wanted to briefly address that issue because it's one that I get a lot, probably because I'm a wee bit younger than most of the folks in this room. That is an issue of framing, that message framing that I was talking about, and actually thinking creatively and active outreach. So for example, when I was working as the New Hampshire coordinator for Safe and Green campaign on the Vermont Yankee campaign and with the Regional SAGE Alliance, I was doing presentations at colleges multiple times a week, and that movement has more young people involved and engaged than anywhere else that I've been so far. It didn't happen by accident. It happened because me and a number of my colleagues with Safe and Green campaign were doing a very intentional outreach campaign to get people educated and involved. It's not that they don't care, it's that no one's talking to them. And when we do, that's why I mentioned the Facebook image earlier with Millerem exposure, no one knows what you're talking about. If you've been doing this work for decades, then you understand what that jargon is, but we need to be very clear that that's jargon. People get very, very interested when we start talking about the environmental justice issues. The front end of the fuel cycle is a huge issue for people when they hear about it. They just don't know about it. The back end, the waste, is a huge issue, but they just don't know about it. And with that, I also want to say that, it's not just young people that are missing in this room, but one of the things I was going to talk about, I kind of ran out of time, is the fact that primarily where these new reactors are being sited, and I actually went through the U.S. Census demographics for each of these communities and took a look at who's in those communities, and it's primarily communities of color with excessively high poverty rates where we've chosen to site these. Places where we already have reactors, yes, but specifically cited in poor communities of color. That's a big issue. And when I look around that room, I don't see those faces here. And so that's another outreach issue where we need to be building meaningful relationships and framing our issues in a way not only that communicates to, say, younger people, but actually building partnerships with impacted reactor communities that aren't represented in this movement yet.
Thank you very much. And
what?
And let's...
Okay, if you are under 30 or under, please stand up.
I think I'm losing control here. Let's turn to the gentleman in the blue shirt who's been waiting very patiently.
Well, I have a lot of questions, comments, but I'll make it very short. My name's Nikos Pastos. I'm from Alaska. I'm an American Indian. We're here with an all-volunteer group. We're a coalition from Alaska Intertribal Council, Alaska's Big Village Network. I work with Center for Water Advocacy. We're collaborating with Haifa Films. They're based here in Chicago. We're making a documentary. If anybody would like to meet with us today or at the reception and put some kind of testimony on film. I work on the front end and the very back end of the nuclear fuel cycle, and we work on the human right to water and water quantity issues. So we, in our legal work, in our advocacy work, we try to curtail governments from permitting the unjust use of water. My questions are, and these are questions and comments at the same time, does anybody here, are you aware that Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska is one of the main sources of funding for the nuclear power plants? We have a small population in Alaska, okay, but and we have no funding to work. Many people, actually communities are concerned, but there's no organization watchdogging, where a lot of the impetus for funding or externalizing all of this unjust waste. Okay, but Alaska is important for many, many reasons. We work with over 230 tribal communities throughout Alaska. It's significant to the food security of the world as well as our national security, and I think the security of human beings, the dignity of human beings. Right now, the Norwegians are pushing a large liquefied natural gas container. They're made in Korea. And they're using nuclear icebreakers from Russian nuclear icebreakers. The other thing is we're looking at vessel traffic coming from the tar sands, which is very radioactive. If we have one large spill of the tar sands, or we have another, there's been many nuclear disasters in the Arctic, which you may or may not know about. Also, we have a lot of uranium, rare earth elements, other energy minerals in Alaska. But if we have one of those containers spill, we have one nuclear ice-breaking accident in the Arctic, we're going to lose a lot of the world's protein source. And so I'm suggesting and asking the panel, I was very happy that, Kendra, you brought up environmental justice. Tribal communities, federally recognized tribes within the United States framework, have special duties that the federal agencies have to give. Right. For government-to-government consultation, yeah, accountability. Okay, has anybody considered working with frontline communities and governments, polities that we have existing, traditional structures that we've had for thousands of years? We need national and international organizing. We don't have any money for this, but a lot of the problems and a lot of the dangers are being borne by frontline communities in Alaska. So, as far as the movements go, we're getting a lot of energy from you. We're here to help document some of that. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Can I make a comment?
I hear a message about money, too.
Quick response?
Yes, I'm going to come to you, Jess. I think that I heard a message about money here, and I think that's an important element, that all of these groups need funding, and I think it's important that we recognize that and make sure that we're giving money as well as time and energy. Yeah, I wanted to turn. We have, two major questions. One is about water and environmental justice. The other is, what can we learn from Germany, Poland, and other countries which may be exiting the nuclear domain?
Well, I'll address the specifically the Alaska water issue. I think that it's important for us all to know that right now, the large reactor renaissance, as it's called, or the relapse, as it really is, it's failed. But The move is afoot now for what they call small modular reactors, so that they're going to look to revive their future in new reactors by building these little ones. And the fight against those little ones really begins in Alaska, interestingly enough, where there's a town there called Galena. Galena's 800 people. Toshiba is very interested and has been in talks with the mayor of Galena to build a what they call the 4S Toshiba, but it's a liquid sodium reactor that they propose to bury under the permafrost, 100 feet under the permafrost on the Yukon River floodplain. So the last of the pristine rivers in the world. There have been negotiations and machinations to put a liquid sodium reactor under the permafrost on the floodplain there in the middle of Alaska. And the entire Yukon River Intertribal Council has mobilized. This is their livelihood. This is their salmon fishing. This is their water source. And that has been a battle that is being won right now. And it is the principal first battle in this emerging battle against small modular reactors. So our hats are off. We've worked with the Yukon River Intertribal Council, and their work is exemplary for the small modular reactor fight that's coming in many places.
Thank you. Kendra, did you want to respond either to the question about Germany, and is there anything to learn from other places that are exiting the nuclear power scene? Anything? I'll just read the bulletin. It's a great issue, and it's got a lot of information about how Germany has done it. It's been a long process.
We're going to hear about that tomorrow.